on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The battered town of Obeznoy. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Miller, Obeznoy, Donbass.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight. The economic crisis in Europe has put people all over the European continent under severe pressure. These days, the capitals of Germany, France and Italy are witnessing the presence of people on the streets, demonstrating and protesting because of rising inflation and increase in energy prices. In Berlin, Paris and Rome, police are suppressing the demonstrators. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews gives us more details. Hundreds of people affected by Germany's cost of living crisis gathered outside the Federal Chancellery in Berlin over the weekend to protest what they say is the increasingly worsening situation in people's lives. Some demonstrators held signs calling for immediate help for the poor, while other placards read, "We need healthy food, abolish poverty." In August, inflation in Germany reached a 50-year high, hitting 8.9%. In May, it had reached 8.7%, a figure not seen since 1973 and 1974 during a previous oil crisis. One protester said, "We're no longer up to our necks in water, we're in the process of sinking. We can't go on, we need help." The demonstrators are calling for help securing decent housing and more support for people in low-income households. The president of the Poverty Network Association, Michael Stifel, said, "Society is becoming very divided. You noticed it in the pandemic. If you only have a two-room flat in Neukölln with five people, or if you come from Ukraine or Syria and have to live in a hostel with five people in one room," Stifel said, "that's poverty, and that's shabby in such a rich country." A yearly report conducted by R&V Versicherung, a German insurance company, found that increasing cost of living in the country was people's top concern, followed by lack of affordable housing and the country's worsening economy. Last year, the German public was mostly worried about tax hikes because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Radio France International, RFI, explains more about the same story. Nearly 3 weeks into a strike that has forced filling stations across France to close, an estimated 140,000 demonstrators took to the streets of Paris on Sunday, 16th of October, in protest against soaring living costs, fuel strikes and climate inaction. According to the organisers of the event, some 140,000 people took part in the March Against High Living Costs and Climate Inaction in Paris on Sunday, 16th of October. The demonstration was organised by the left-wing Noops Alliance, led by the hard-left France Unbowed LFI party. The leader of the LFI party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, has lauded the huge success of the march, specifically praising the significant turnout. However, French police maintain just 30,000 demonstrators took part in last Sunday's event, as they had earlier predicted. Left-wing opponents of President Emmanuel Macron's administration had organised the demonstrations for last Sunday, 16th of October, which they said is also in protest against government inaction over climate change. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, firebrand leader of the left-wing France Unbowed political party, had planned the march well before the current strike, but organisers are hoping to pick up some of the momentum from the current industrial action. According to the deputy leader of France Unbowed LFI party, Manon Aubry,
The rise in prices is unbearable. It is the greatest loss of purchasing power in the past 40 years. La Presse Digitale newspaper has also covered the same story. Dozens of protesters led by USB Union burnt energy bills outside CDP Bank in Rome, Italy recently as part of a rally against the rising cost of living. The participants in the rally chanted and held placards with some reading, "We're not paying the bills and we're not paying for your crisis and your wars." In Rome, Milan and other Italian cities, citizens took to the streets against rising energy prices and set fire to their bills. The mobilization against price increases was launched by the union USB in protest against unjustified increases in domestic utility bills. According to the protesters, increases linked to speculation that the government must remedy to avoid a social revolt in the coming months. In the capital, Rome, gas and electricity bills on fire under the headquarters of Cassa Depositi e Prestiti in Milan instead flash mobbed the soaring energy prices in Piazza Cavour in front of the headquarters of ARERA, the regulatory authority for energy networks and environment, where a giant facsimile of a bill was burnt to manifest in a blatant way the opposition of the policies of the state also in the field of energy. As the energy crisis continues to bite in Italy, people from all walks of life have been staging protests across the country. High school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they called 2 decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout rate in the European Union. They sent out a warning to the next government saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards. Then on Saturday, 15th of October, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the Italian government building. The initiative was organised by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally. Italy is in the process to install a new government as Mario Draghi's government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right party, Brothers of Italy, has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader, Giorgia Meloni, is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. Many other protests and demonstrations have been held in Italy in recent days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by an energy plant's employees against plans to shut down their factory. Also, Italy's largest trade union, CGIL, staged a big demonstration in Rome several days ago, demanding more protection for Italian workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seems to have just started in the country.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
You know, as many times during the past few weeks, Iran has denied sending combat drones to Russia for the Ukraine war. But the so-called international community is only listening to the claims that are being made by the U.S., Ukraine, and European countries. Russia has also denied it. Why then is the West, after accusing Iran of something that it has not done? Is it to make up for their military failures? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what state the Ukraine conflict is actually in and why peace seems in some ways elusive. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us, author and commentator John Stempling, who joins us from Inderøy, Norway.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Stepling, first to you. The accusation, Iran has agreed to supply drones and surface-to-surface missiles to Russia. At least that's what the Americans are saying. Also, Ukraine and European officials are saying the same thing. Both Russia and Iran have denied that. What do you think about the accusation that's being leveled?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is in the habit of making baseless accusations, ones without any proof. They rarely supply any evidence or proof for these accusations. But the other question is, why is this wrong exactly? All of the EU is contributing weapons to Ukraine. The United States is funneling billions of dollars of ordnance and weaponry, and they've helped with training and so forth, all into Ukraine. It's been a massive windfall for the military-industrial complex, and it should be noted that only something like 30% of those weapons make it to the battlefield in Ukraine. And a lot of that weaponry is outdated and probably couldn't have been sold anyway, so they just give it to Ukraine. But this is the same question. Iran is always demonized. They want to have a nuclear bomb. Well, why is it okay for all these other countries to have nuclear weapons but not Iran? Who decides that? The United States always engages in a kind of rhetoric where the assumption is that they are the final arbiter of what the rules are. And this is just nonsense. So I don't think Iran has done what they say, but I don't much care if they did. Who cares? This is a U.S. fomented crisis, 100% manufactured by the West. It was planned even before the Maidan coup in 2014, which the U.S. orchestrated. The U.S. has targeted Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. They interfered in the 96 election that they helped get Yeltsin elected, on and on. So this is just the kind of constant stream of propaganda that has been coming out of the U.S. and the West, propaganda the likes of which I have never seen. Just
okay.
Stunning bald-faced lies.
We need to obviously cover what both sides have said, John Bosnich. So let's take a look at what Iran has said. The foreign ministry spokesperson has said, basically rejecting this, saying it's baseless accusation. Tehran was committed to, based on his words, active neutrality and opposition to the war and the need for political settlements of the differences between the two sides, which would be away from violence. Can't forget how about a month ago you had the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who actually delivered a message to Russia to convey from the European side, and it was said to be from actually the French President Emmanuel Macron, that, let's figure out a peaceful solution to this. So that's what Iran's side is saying. What is your thought on that and, of course, the accusation?
Well, everything that comes out of the mouth of America's government or its centrally controlled media, mainstream media, which literally replicate stories issued by government media outlets, everything that comes out of those mouths is pre-programmed in advance. There's an assessment made of what would be the damage or the effect of producing this propaganda news, what we might expect to do domestically with the generated public response, and what we can do internationally with the generated public response. And I say this having worked in state media in various countries around the world, and I know how this is done. So the United States, in a time of war, always faces a small but noisy isolationist factor inside its political body. And the isolationist factor benefits from arguing against war in general. So when the government of the United States faces too much internal opposition to a war, they tend to combine two demonized foes. And in this scenario, from the very beginning of the conflict in Russia, America has combined China as a guilty party for not sanctioning Russia. Now, as we see, the Americans are becoming more desperate in the conduct of the war, which is not going well for them or for their cannon fodder in Ukraine. We see them drawing in Iran as another target of historic American demonization. And the basic theory is if you can demonize three together, the people of America will be more ready for war than if you are only demonizing one party. That's what's happening now.
Yeah, a couple important points that you made there, and I'd like to ask you, John Stepling. First of all, let's get on to one of them, and that is the fact that we're looking at the way that, this war has had its ups and downs. But you have, on the one side, media reporting that Russia is on the back foot, that it's not doing well. On the other hand, when we get these types of developments, like these drones being thrown into the picture, accusing Iran of providing it to Russia, then some say that shows that Ukraine is not doing well militarily. So is that one of the things that's happening here? They're not doing well militarily. They've got to have an angle to go after, and they're using this.
Russia's doing fine militarily. Every report that you hear about Russian failures, desertions, incompetence, lack of weaponry, supply shortages, etc., all of it is from the Western press, and none of it is true. It's simply not true, and Russia is doing fine. They have shown enormous restraint, actually, because for a variety of reasons, but primarily because it's in their interest to do this efficiently and without, a lot of shock and awe. But once the terror attacks happened, the bridge and the Nord Stream and so forth, Russia appointed a more hardline general to carry out the mission, and he sort of took the gloves off. The only country that is not doing well is Ukraine. They are running out of soldiers. They're running out of everything. Zelensky is ever more strident and sort of petulant and almost hysterical and demanding help from the EU and the United States. And remember, there are massive protests across the EU. Nobody can afford the cost of living. There's no jobs. The West in general is facing something of an economic crisis, and the EU does what the United States tells it to do, and the military-industrial complex, the defense industry, makes a lot of money out of this, and that's one of the primary engines for all of this. But no, Russia's doing fine, and they will conclude this operation probably before too long. It will only, the only question remains exactly what the final terms will be with Ukraine and the U.S. It does worry. There are voices that express a great deal of worry that the United States doesn't want to feel humiliated, that a false flag is on the horizon, that Poland will get involved, there will be attack against Belarus. There are all these theories, but I don't think any of them are going to happen.
Sure. Well, the false flag is not going to be too false when the Republicans take over. At least that's what the projections are. Okay, so John Busness, you mentioned something about how they want to group Iran, Russia, and China in order to go after them as one force, perhaps, that needs to be demonized. That's a very interesting statement because we're looking at, if I can bring this up, what the State Department has said, that the deepening alliance between Russia and Iran is a profound threat that countries across the world should actually monitor. So this gives one incentive behind why perhaps this scenario is being painted of accusing Iran, et cetera. So is that what we're looking at, one of the aims of why perhaps they're accusing Iran of this?
The expanding a negative scenario for America is getting worse day by day. To try to get ahead of the wave of damage that is going to be delivered to their interests, they are now becoming aggressive. And in that sense, they accuse other countries of potential threats that they could pose without any evidence, and then begin to crank the gears of pressure on those countries as well, hoping that those countries might make a provocative act that America could use as a causus belli, as a reason to initiate another side war. And that raises the specter of world war and therefore raises the demand for more money to be spent on the military, of which the corrupt military-industrial complex takes a massive percentage directly into their pockets. No war means no money. Mm-hmm. Big war means big money. That's the way the United States military-industrial complex rules the American government. And Biden, in that whole game, is just as much a joker as Zelensky is. Both of them are owned by the same military-industrial complex.
Indeed. Well, here's the thing, John Stepling. There's a camp out there that says, wait a minute, and I think you mentioned that in your statements, John Stepling, that what is wrong with Iran, for example, selling military equipment or drones or ballistic missiles or what have you? The camp is saying that they're disagreeing with what the U.S. and European partners are doing, is that, if anybody helps Russia, does that mean that they have to go under sanctions, that sanctions have to be placed on that country? For example, OPEC Plus comes and says 2 million barrels cut per day. So do they have to now be sanctioned? Because the way U.S. sees it, Russia is making money off of that. So let's go sanction OPEC Plus. So they're going with that approach. Do they have a right to view it that way?
Well, I mean, of course not. But the U.S., it's always difficult to tell exactly if the U.S. calculations have failed or not. The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years. And, by all appearances, it was an abject failure, except that, of course, the defense industry and a lot of private security firms made massive profits out of that 20 years. They also extracted a lot of resources from Afghanistan illegally. So the U.S. sanctions Russia, thinking that was going to weaken and overextend Russia somehow. That was what the Rand Corporation paper prophesied. And it's been a stunning failure. Russia just asked that the transactions take place in rubles, and the U.S. Didn't impose any real hardship on Russia with this. And remember also, the U.S. is over the last probably since 2008, have been terribly concerned that the international reserve currency might stop being the dollar. And every time that discussion comes up, the specter of China looms on the horizon. And this is one of the primary fears for the U.S. But, the U.S. does things like help coordinate the assassination of Soleimani, They falsely imprison people all the way back to the breakup of Yugoslavia. I mean, we could go on and on and list U.S. crimes, covert, overt, all foreign policy activities that have been illegal. Mm-hmm. And yet they make a big fuss about, but Iran is selling drones. If it weren't such a serious situation, it would be laughable because it's just an absurd thing. And yet, you know, propaganda works. A lot of the American public are up in arms about the evil Putin and the evil Russian Empire, and it's just not true.
Well, we need to talk about the military aspect a little bit more here, John Bosnich. And one thing that has been described about these drones is that they're so effective that they say it flies at low altitude, and Russia sends out swarms of them, and it's able to do some extensive damage. At the same time, they're saying, you know, Russia is running low on equipment. It's got dwindling supply of whatever equipment that they're running out of. So if this is working for them, then why isn't Ukraine reacting with supplies of their own? Are they coming out short themselves then? Which then points to the fact that they are weakened when it comes to the military aspect of this vis-a-vis Russia.
Well, just coming at the question from the military point of view, I've sat myself for 78 days here in Belgrade and across the rest of Serbia under American aerial bombardment every day, several times a day, with what they called smart bombs. And the entire Western world was fine with that. There was no sanctions against America. There was no such activity. Now, in the situation in Ukraine today, we have a situation in which the Russian army intervened in compliance with the Western principle of the responsibility to protect an ethnic minority of Russians who were under pressure from American-backed military forces attacking civilians. Russia has intervened after waiting 8 years of this kind of genocidal activity. The idea that Russia, during that period, would not have been able to produce its own drones or to copy under license and mass-produce drones that perhaps may have been designed in Iran in the past is inconceivable, because the Russian defense and military production industry is many tens of times faster, bigger, and better equipped than the Iranian military defense system. And not only that, at the very beginning of this conflict, the Russian forces had stockpiles of drones, having learned from the battles in Azerbaijan and having learned already from previous battles on the periphery of Russia. So there's no possibility whatsoever that this relatively low-intensity war in Ukraine has even scratched the surface of the domestic supply of Russian drones.
Good
up
point.
Until today.
Good point. I need to, since you talked about how Russian or American missiles were being rained down, John Stepling, I do have to mention something that former Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif did say about how Iraq was being provided during the eight-year war with so many weapons from Western countries that there was nobody, as he said, nobody that was providing Iran with any missiles of any kind, and bombs were being rained down on Iran, killing many Iranians. What happened? Why was there no UN action when it came to the countries providing those missiles that were bombing Iran during the eight-year war?
Because there's always a double standard. And you know, as I said earlier, we could sit here and list U.S. crimes, and the bombing of Belgrade is a perfect example. That also, the breakup of the former Yugoslavia is significant because that was the trial balloon for expanding NATO into a kind of offensive military organization. And Clinton tried it. They weren't certain public opinion was going to be on their side, but they employed the same propaganda against Milosevic and the Serbs that they are employing against Putin now. They illegally kidnapped Milosevic, took him to an ad hoc tribunal in The Hague, et cetera, et cetera. We know that story. The U.S. sees itself as immune from any prosecution. It essentially is, because it owns organizations, so-called international organizations like the UN. Russia went to the UN in 2018, by the way, asking for peacekeepers to be sent to Ukraine. They pleaded to send peacekeepers. When they finally took action this last year and went into Donbass, the people in that region saw Putin as stopping a war, not starting a war. They had endured 7 years of shelling and 14,000 civilian deaths, and this is never, ever mentioned in the Western press when they discuss the unprovoked Russian attack on Ukraine. So it's just nonsense. But you know, it's the United States that has 900 military bases around the world. Nobody else. Russia has like three or something outside its borders in former satellite countries and one in Syria. The United States has 900. There's almost not a country in Africa that doesn't have a significant U.S. military base. So, you know, all of this double standard is, as I say, almost laughable. Because it just flies in the face of historical reality.
Well, let's take a look at a piece of news here that may be bad news for Zelensky, John Bosnich, and that is how U.S. Republicans have issued a statement through the House Minority Leader saying that we're not going to write a blank check for Ukraine if we take control of the House. And they said that those days are going to be over, and Ukraine is going to be facing a tough fight for getting funding from the U.S. Do you think that that is indeed what's going to happen? And what, if it does, what would that spell for Ukraine and then for the whole conflict, in a sense?
Well, if that does happen, and if the Republicans regain control of the House, there's absolutely going to be an about-face on several aspects of Biden's very aggressive foreign policy, especially in Ukraine. Former President Trump was making it clear that his priority and the priority of the new Trump version of the Republican Party was going to be building the economy at home. This war is far beyond the saber-rattling that Trump used against Iran and the saber-rattling that Trump used against China. This is an out-and-out, full-scale, multi-billion-dollar expenditure from the American taxpayers' pocket to feed the companies that put Biden in power. Now, it's a question of whether the companies in America are stronger than the people of America. We'll see next month when they have their election.
Okay, final question to you, John Stepling. Are we looking at political motive when it comes to the U.S. Vis-a-vis Iran, given the fact that if we put that into the JCPOA revival talks, since that has either reached a dead end or is on life support, that maybe the electricity has taken off that, it's just not beating anymore, that perhaps they want to pressure Iran in this way? Is there a possibility of that?
Well, I suppose, you know, I suppose it's a possibility. What goes on in the brains of Biden's, you know, inner circle is anyone's guess. Remember that this, you know, Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan and Blinken and all of these people are heavily influenced by that sort of Straussian neocon philosophy that began under Reagan. We have seen this foreign policy from Democrats and Republicans alike, but I think at this point, when people see the massive protests in Europe, when they see the growing crisis of homelessness and social unrest in the United States, the unemployment figures are stunning. There's no growth. The U.S. produces nothing except despair at this point. You know, politically, the Republican Party needs to probably do, as your other guest said, an about face on a lot of Biden policies. His approval ratings are at an unprecedented low. I don't think there's ever been a U.S. president with approval ratings quite as low as Biden has right now. And he's something of a laughing stock. So pressuring Iran, you know, they pressure Venezuela, they pressure Iran, they pressure China. This is just pro forma, you know, the usual rhetoric that comes out of the White House and Washington. I don't know how much importance it has at this point. the sanctions on Iran, you know, the JCPOA has to be on the back burner at this point. You know, there's no country that doesn't constitute an almost client state. You can't find one that isn't sanctioned. Any right. sign of autonomy or disobedience, you get sanctioned. It's astounding, actually. So, okay. Yeah, I don't know. They're going to continue to demonize Iran, though. That's for certain.
Thank you very much. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. That was John Stepling from Inderøy, Norway, author and commentator. John Busnich, thank you. From Belgrade, journalist, activist, and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The British government has spent the past few weeks turning announcements about taxation and spending into moments of political theatre. On 23rd of September, a fiscal event dubbed the mini-budget introduced the largest package of tax cuts in half a century. A medium-term fiscal plan eventually scheduled for 31st of October was to set out the more trivial details, like how it will be paid for. On 17th of October, Jeremy Hunt, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, cancelled £32 billion of those tax cuts, ripping up virtually the whole of the mini-budget. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Jeremy Hunt has shredded Liz Truss's economic plans in one of the most astonishing U-turns in modern political history, including slashing the energy price freeze, which the Prime Minister had repeatedly championed. The new Chancellor of the Exchequer dismantled almost all of the platform that Liz Truss's leadership victory had been built on, including the majority of her tax cuts, and hinted a new windfall tax was in his sights, a move that the Prime Minister had previously said she would not countenance. Jeremy Hunt also refused to rule out cuts to totemic Conservative pledges, including defence spending and the pensions triple lock. Liz Truss declined to appear at the dispatch box in Parliament on Monday, 17th of October, despite calls from Labour, leading one cabinet minister to clarify that she was not hiding under a desk. In an interview with the BBC on Monday night, She said she wanted to accept responsibility and say sorry for the mistakes that have been made. I wanted to act to help people with their energy bills and to deal with the issue of high taxes, but we went too far and too fast, she said. With her premiership in grave doubt, sources at No. 10 Downing Street told The Guardian that Liz Truss met Sir Graham Brady, the powerful chair of the 1922 committee, where they discussed the scale of Conservative MPs' anger. A new poll from Redfield and Wilton gave Labour a 36-point lead, the largest for any political party from any polling company since October of 1997. In a statement on Monday morning, Jeremy Hunt said the 20p basic tax rate would remain indefinitely and reversed a swathe of other tax measures, including changes to dividend taxes, a VAT-free shopping scheme, and a freeze on some alcohol duties. But the biggest shock came when the Chancellor said he would no longer guarantee energy prices for the next two winters, and that more targeted measures would replace the universal guarantee from next spring after a Treasury review. It means the average annual energy bill will rise to more than £4,000 from April. According to the sector's leading forecaster, and analysts say it could lead to a rise of almost 5 percentage points in the annual inflation rate. Inflation currently stands at 9.9%, and is expected to rise slightly when the figure for September is announced on Tuesday. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the £32 billion tax increases, the biggest since 1993, would not be enough on their own to undo the damage caused by the debacle of the past few weeks. Paul Johnson, the think tank's director, said the Chancellor's decision to scrap most of the tax cuts announced last month was welcome, but would not be enough to plug the gap in the government's fiscal plans. Jeremy Hunt will use his next fiscal statement, due on 31st of October, to outline how the government intends to reduce public sector debt as a share of national income over time. Estimates of what it would take to achieve this range between £60 billion and £72 billion. The only key tax announcement to survive were the cancellation of the national insurance rise and stamp duty changes, both already subject to new legislation. Jeremy Hunt refused to rule out changes to the pensions triple lock and said a new windfall tax on energy profits was on the table. "I'm not against the principle of taxing profits that are genuine windfalls," he told the House of Commons. Few in Westminster believe Liz Truss's premiership is secure even with the significant reversals. One member of the 1922 executive said the group could take action this week, either by changing the rules or sending Sir Graham Brady to tell Liz Truss it was over. "When the herd moves," they said. The Economist magazine gives us more details about the same story. Jeremy Hunt was rushing to calm financial markets that his predecessor as Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, had well and truly spooked. Britain's currency and its government debt or gilts cratered in the wake of growth plan that Mr. Kwarteng laid out on 23rd of September. The gilt sell-off was so sharp that it forced some pension funds into fire sales, creating a self-reinforcing feedback loop and threatening financial instability. An emergency bond-buying programme from the Bank of England, along with Mr. Kwarteng's defenestration, went some way to restoring order. But as the central bank's intervention came to an end on 14th of October, gilt yields, which move inversely to prices, were rising ominously once again. Jeremy Hunt's statement today was designed to reassure the markets once and for all that the government is fully committed to fiscal responsibility. It has brought some much-needed breathing space,
The 30-year gilt yield, which breached 4.8% on Friday, fell back to 4.4%. The pound, worth less than $1.12 on Friday, rose to around $1.14. But the price of all this has been the wholesale destruction of the tax-cutting agenda that brought Liz Truss to power. She had already announced the reinstatement of a corporation tax rise she had previously promised to scrap, and before that, reversed the move to abolish the top rate of income tax. In addition, Jeremy Hunt today cancelled promised cuts to the basic rate of income tax and the dividend tax rate, as well as a planned freeze on alcohol duty rates and a VAT-free shopping scheme for visitors to Britain. A cut to national insurance, a payroll tax, remains, for now at least. So does a small cut to stamp duty, a tax on property transactions, as well as some other bits and pieces. But Liz Truss's economic programme is virtually dead. So is the philosophy that underpinned it, that tax cuts could pay for themselves by stimulating economic growth. The wing of the Conservative Party that advocates sound money is firmly in the ascendancy. But more pain is to come. Jeremy Hunt also promised a review of the blank cheque the government signed in offering to protect households and businesses from higher energy costs, aiming to make it more targeted and less expensive after April of 2023. Prior to his statements, Britain's public finances faced a hole in the medium term, reported to be around £70 billion per year. Taken together, the Chancellor's announcements may take the shortfall down to around £40 billion. Jeremy Hunt warned of difficult decisions ahead. Mr. Hunt's extraordinary elevation has been as striking as Liz Truss's political implosion after two unsuccessful tilts at the party leadership. Until a fortnight ago, Jeremy Hunt's career in high office seemed to be over. He finished second behind Boris Johnson in the Conservative Party's leadership contest in 2019. In the contest of 2022, he gathered the support of just 18 MPs. His background as a Remainer made him an unlikely fit for a party that has become more dogmatic since the Brexit referendum of 2016. Now he is the Prime Minister in all but name. Yet even he is not really in charge. For the foreseeable future, Britain's fiscal policy will be dictated not by what its politicians want, but rather by what the bond markets will bear.